It's brand new, season two. I'm Marissa Thalberg.
And I'm Stephen Wolf Bedeta. And we're excited to be back having bigger, bolder, and always real conversations.
Straight from the C-suite front lines of marketing, media, and more.
We have great friends joining from people you may know, like Wilmer Valderrama and Bobby Burke.
And people you'll want to know. So grab a coffee or, hey, even an Aperol Spritz and come join us on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Listen to Brand New on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and my podcast, Climbing in Heels, is back and better than ever. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. Climbing in Heels is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters. With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Johnny B. Goode, the host of the podcast Creating a Con, The Story of BitCon. This podcast dives deep into the story of Ray Trapani and his company, CentraTech. I'll explore how 320-somethings built a company out of lies, deceit, and greed.
I've been saying since a very young age that I was going to be a millionaire. If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
Listen to Creating a Con, The Story of BitCon on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places. Welcome to Forward Thinking.
Hi, and welcome to Forward Thinking, the show that looks at the future and says, who can tell what magic spells will be doing for us? I'm Lauren Vogelbaum.
And I'm Joe McCormick. And our host, Jonathan Strickland, is out today because he was not feeling well.
Yes, we decided to allow him that.
Yeah, but we hope he is feeling better soon. And today, we're going to be recording without him, but he will be back next time.
Yes, and he is here very much in spirit with us because, okay, so we're talking today about virtual reality.
Virtual reality? That's the future if it's 1990.
Yeah. According to every single movie that came out during that entire decade, and also most of Star Trek The Next Generation, this is all going to be virtual reality from
right
here on out. Just Max Headroom will rule us all.
Yeah, like you were saying, though, Jonathan is with us in spirit.
Right, because he wrote a couple of really great articles on how stuff works that we have used to kind of form the basis of our information here. Mm-hmm. We can link those out somewhere on the interwebs that are easy to find.
Yeah.
But I have never actually used a virtual reality headset, but I hear, Joe, that you have some experience with this.
I have a couple times. I remember there was like So I was at a music festival sometime in the 90s when I was a kid. It was the Riverbend Festival in Chattanooga.
Okay.
And they had this tent there that was like a traveling tent where they had virtual reality set up. But I barely remember it. I just remember I stood in line for a really long time, and I think I got to play for like 5 minutes, and it cost, you know, like all the money I had at that time. I don't remember much about the experience except that it went over my head and I was sitting in a chair and I was using these controllers and it was
like a typical like game, like console controller kind of thing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It was fairly immersive. Also, the other thing was, I don't know if you remember, do you remember the Virtual Boy?
I do not personally, but I have read some really entertaining things about it on the internet.
AKA the Red Headache Machine. It's okay. Just imagine like a, what are those things? The viewfinder,
The little clickety things.
Yeah, like one of those little clicker things. Sure. Okay, so it's like you strap one of those to your head, except it's really big, and it only shows you two colors, black and red, and it causes migraines.
That sounds like the best video game. Sign me up.
When the Virtual Boy came out, I can't remember how old I was. I was probably like, I'm going to guess like seventh grade or something.
Uh-huh.
And it came out, one of my friends got one, and we all got together at his house, and we were like, well, we're going to play this thing. And the way it is at the time, like when you're a little kid, like you don't realize things are bad. It's like, you know,
everything is fun and new and exciting. And in even a kind of terrible experience is like, oh man, why did I do that? It was great.
Yeah. Like I never realized there was such thing as a bad movie. It's like, I just saw Operation Dumbo Drop. It was great. Let's go see it again. You know, and so, but yeah, I just thought this thing was awesome. Meanwhile, we were like kids sitting there, like just taking Tylenol from his parents.
No. And,
like,
no.
Because it was really painful to the eyes. And it was just an awful experience of red pain at the bridge of your nose.
The screens in these things were made of LEDs, which was actually pretty impressive at the time, because most video screens were being made of LCDs, liquid crystal displays, or they were still cathode ray tubes.
Mm-hmm.
So it was an impressive technological feat. But the thing about red LEDs, especially at the time, is that it was made of this because they were so cheap and so bright. They were the brightest, cheapest LEDs that they could possibly make. And I don't think that anyone thought to like install the dimmer switch in there. This was a terrible, terrible disaster for Nintendo, wasn't it?
I think so. Well, I mean, a couple of things to say about it. number one, it wasn't really virtual reality, was it? I mean, depends on how you define it, but actually let's refer to Jonathan's definition in the article, because I think it's pretty good.
Sure. He defines it from two points.
Mm-hmm.
The first being three-dimensional images that appear to be life-sized from the perspective of the user.
Okay, so it was kind of that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there was a lot of like simulated 3D based on these sort of red lattices and stuff like that.
Okay.
But the other thing is the ability to track the user's motions, particularly head or eye movements, and adjust the images on the user's display to reflect the change in perspective.
And the Virtual Boy was, I mean, essentially table mounted,
yeah,
wasn't it?
It sat on a stand, like a tripod stand, and you just put your face in it and you wouldn't move around.
Okay.
I mean, you'd move around when you get dizzy and start falling out of the chair, but it wasn't supposed to be moving with you, and it wouldn't follow you.
Yeah. You didn't strap it to your head.
Okay. So it was a thing that a lot of people were thinking of as virtual reality, but it wasn't quite there. What we're thinking about with virtual reality is something that's a more natural experience that stays with your face in a way. Like you are having this experience and you're not going to be able to just look away from it.
Right. I think the kind of hope and dream is that Star Trek holodeck kind of thing where you're just immersed in a virtual environment and to the point where you can interact with objects there and barely even tell the fact that it's virtual.
Yeah.
Hopefully, except not with like the messy, like every single time they went to the holodeck, something completely terrible happened and like Moriarty took over the ship and whatever. So,
yeah.
So without that part. But historically speaking, this has been in the works for a really long time, or I mean, you know, a relatively long time since the 1960s anyway.
Yeah, I was going to ask.
And, so the very first kind of example that we have of anything even vaguely like this is, Morton Helig's Sensorama, which was in 1960, was a stereoscopic head-mounted display that also involved like fans and scent squirters and stereo speakers and a moving chair, which overall sounds completely miserable to me personally. Although I've been on some rides at like Disney and Universal Studios that seem a little bit similar, but I can imagine that in 1960, this wasn't actually an extraordinarily pleasant experience.
You know, in 1960, there were a lot of bad movies out there and gimmicks like 3D.
Know,
they could really pull you in. And I guess this is just like the ultimate gimmick for the sensory experience of the movie.
And I'm picturing like a film probably not quite to the high quality of Vincent Price's work that would have just been, I don't know, like giant spiders. I'm not sure what giant spiders smell like, but it was probably very particular.
They smell like watermelons, actually.
Really?
Yeah.
Science fact.
Yeah. Okay. No, not really.
Now, okay, so the first real head-mounted display was created in 1961 by Philco Corporation. That was called the Headsight, and this was a video feed only. Yeah, Headsight. The names are only going to get more clever.
So creative.
And this was video. It wasn't computer generated. So it was hooked up to a camera, and you could use it like in dangerous situations where you want to send a camera instead of a person. And people could use that camera to look around or if you, hooked it up to an like infrared camera feed on the bottom of a helicopter, the pilot could use that to look around and figure out what was going on. Later on in the '60s, we started getting the concepts for what we think of as being VR today. And that's a computer generated image that is being fed through a headset, hypothetically, tethered to tethered physically to a giant computer and hypothetically with some kind of motion tracking in the headset. But he never, the guy creating this, Ivan Sutherland at the time did not come up with anything vaguely close to that in like physical prototype, I don't think.
Okay.
It would take another couple of decades and involvement from like NASA and the Department of Defense and the National Science Foundation and the CIA before we started getting kind of industrial use virtual reality stuff to help train astronauts for spacewalks and a flight and vehicle sim kind of stuff.
Oh,
and
yeah.
It wasn't until like 1984 that a guy named Michael McGreevy started experimenting with using this kind of technology as a computer interface, which is what we're really talking about when we're talking about video games and virtual reality, which is kind of what we're going to move into in the second half of this podcast. So it wasn't, that fascinates me that we had this kind of concept for a really long time. It was never called virtual reality until after all of that in 1987 when Jaron Lanier coined the term. But that's, I think, when the media finally picked up on the fact that this existed. And that
did they pick up all those horrible virtual reality movies.
Yeah.
What were some of them?
Oh, we were talking right before the podcast about Virtuosity, which I hadn't even thought about in decades. That was tiny chibi Russell Crowe. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. He plays when he's like a digital serial killer in some police training module who, he like escapes into the real world.
Of course,
and,
of course.
You know, struts around while staying alive, plays behind him. And of course, he's going to, I don't know, like kill people with pixels. I don't remember what he did.
I do not. I think I blocked most of that out.
He just like walks up to you and gives you the blue screen of death. Oh no.
Strange Days, I guess, is kind of similar to that.
Okay.
A much better version of virtual reality aside from the kind of terrible part of it. It's virtual memories. I don't know.
Okay.
I'm not sure if that counts or not.
I know there were a bunch of these movies.
Of course, Lawnmower Man. I don't know.
Oh, yeah. Lawnmower Man. You got to go with that one. What a horrible movie.
And sequels. There was at least one sequel to that involved.
Well, so the media and movies and everything really took this concept of virtual reality and ran with it. And we're still suffering from that today. The fact that this technology just got horribly, horribly overhyped.
I mean, because the computer processing, we're still catching up to a point where we can create a headset that's going to be convincingly real looking from, and hey, computers have developed a lot in the past couple decades, and we're still kind of like almost there, but not quite.
Yeah, not to mention just the graphics back then were terrible and
everything.
Yeah. I mean, it.
And the expectation, I think, was immediately that it's going to look like high quality video or something like that.
Where, it's
going to
be just like real life.
Right.
It was insanity. And then when people really got to experience what we were talking about with,
through something like Virtual Boy.
Yeah. Which wasn't even really virtual reality. I mean, even if they did what I did and then went to some tent where they had a virtual reality station set up, it had to be massively disappointing.
Oh, sure.
Like it could not have competed with what you saw in the movies and what you assumed when you heard some news story about it or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So I think virtual reality is still suffering from this. It was this big calamity of overhype and underperformance of the hardware and just nothing really cool about it. And now when you think of that, or at least when I think of it, I just groan like, oh.
Go like, oh, don't even talk to me about virtual reality.
Yeah. So virtual reality is dead, right?
Oh, yeah, totally dead. That's absolutely why the Oculus Rift raised $2,437,429 in their Kickstarter campaign at the end of 2012.
Big surprise, actually. The cool thing is that while everybody was so over virtual reality, it was actually getting good.
And, okay, so Palmer Luckey is the guy who kind of originally created the idea for the Oculus Rift. He was working at the time with a virtual reality exposure therapy program that helps veterans with PTSD.
Oh yeah, I've heard of that.
Yeah, and but those are huge expensive machines, and he was a hobbyist who kind of wanted something that didn't cost, you know, $1,500 to play with on his own. He really couldn't find anything out there in the wild that was going to be anything like that. So he decided to kind of start putting something like that together for himself. And it really captured the public's imagination. This stuff isn't out yet, but they've raised some like $16 million in private funding and all kinds of crazy stuff. Because up until now, up to and including now, real virtual reality systems are kind of these weird, like GLaDOS looking things. I mean, like it's tethered to a huge computer. It's usually a headset that's so heavy and bulky that your neck would snap if you tried to wear it and turn your head around. So it's on a suspension
system. Like articulating
arm. Yeah. It's really not cool or pretty or portable or inexpensive in any way. You know, though these things do exist, like, you know, I want to specify that's absolutely a real thing. You know, why would we want this for video gaming? Why would we want to take this out of the laboratory, and out of the kind of GLaDOS setting and turn it into a video game?
Well, I've got a theory about that, actually.
Yeah.
So I don't know if you've read about the ideas of connecting video games with the concept in positive psychology of flow. Have you heard of this?
Not really. Explain it to me.
Okay, so flow is a really interesting concept, and it comes from psychologist named, and I hope I'm doing this right, Mihai Csikszentmihalyi.
Sounds good to me.
Yeah. He ain't from around here.
Apologies if that's incorrect.
Yeah, but he comes up with this idea that there seems to be this really, really pleasurable state that people can get themselves into. And you can sort of imagine it if you imagine like an XY graph.
Okay.
So you look at it and you imagine the X-axis is a person's level of skill.
Okay.
Okay. And then you look at the Y-axis, and that is the challenge of a task.
Okay. This is actually a problem that I have frequently when I play video games, because I kind of want to get to the next story point, but sometimes I get very frustrated with the technical ability that it's making me perform in button combinations and whatever.
Yeah, well, in that case, that game might not be optimized for flow, or at least you might not be playing it at the right difficulty or something
right,
like that. But so there are different regions of this graph, right? If you can imagine different tasks, like if you're down here at the bottom on both, that just seems like a really boring area. Like nothing's difficult and you're not good at anything.
Sure.
You know, and meanwhile, if you go over, say like you're doing something that is not very challenging, but you're really good at it, well, that can be easy, but it's not super engaging.
Right. You're not really, you're not teasing your brain. You're not learning and growing.
Yeah.
So.
If you go, say, like really high on the Y-axis, but not far on the X-axis, that's like a state of problems, of nervousness and anxiety. You're not adequate and you can't do what you need to do.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a really uncomfortable place to be in. But imagine you're up at performing very high on both axes.
Uh-huh.
You're doing something that is at the peak of challenge and your peak of skill. And so
you're rocking out something that's really hard.
Yeah. A lot of people have phrased this as like getting in the zone, you know,
uh-huh.
or being on a roll. It's when you're fully engaged in a task that is consuming all of your mind. You're putting yourself fully into it. You're getting immediate feedback and you're doing it well.
That sounds awesome.
Yeah. And so a lot of people talk about flow in other contexts, like, say, artistic work. Like if you're a writer and you suddenly you get a burst of energy and you're just writing and you're going, you know, or if you're a painter or a musician, I imagine like if you're, say, a jazz guitar player and you're, mm-hmm. you're improvising and you're having a great session with some other players, you can be in that zone where what you're doing is at the peak of your skill and you're doing it very well and you're fully immersed in it.
Mm-hmm.
But apparently a reason people play video games is that video games are very good at encouraging a state of flow where there's a task where the goals are clear.
Mm-hmm.
It fully engages your attention. It
sure.
takes, it's somewhat difficult, so it takes skill to do it. And it's something that you can do.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, and it provides sort of like a rhythm of rewards and feedback on your performance. It's uh-huh. a steady incremental accomplishment. This is what makes video games really fun, in my opinion. And,
uh-huh.
and I'm this idea doesn't come from me. Other people have suggested it, but I think sure. I agree with it.
Oh, absolutely. I think that's why they can get, you know, pretty addicting sometimes.
Right. But so there are a couple of problems with video games that can interrupt this experience of flow.
Mm-hmm.
One of them is distraction. Okay,
uh-huh.
so you know if you're playing on a TV screen across the room, other things in the room can get your attention.
Sure. And, you know, if the dog walks in front of the screen, or if the screen quality is poor, and
yeah.
Or if you're getting a reflection of from a light behind
yeah,
you
glare,
or something.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Or just the simple sort of ambient awareness that you're using a TV across the room. You know what I mean?
Sure. That you're not really in the terrible town of Silent Hill, and that
yeah.
that well, I mean, in that case, actually, that's pretty much good for me. I'm fine with having that level of awareness.
Yeah, and the other thing is that you're aware of your tools.
Uh-huh.
And so you're aware that you're holding a controller,
uh-huh.
at least in some ambient sense. You're at low-level awareness of this. You're manipulating buttons to do what you need to do.
That you're not moving, that you're manipulating something.
Yeah,
right?
it's not as natural as maybe, say, like playing a sport, where you're just using your body in kind of like full immersed involvement in the task.
Which for most people in most situations is a very extremely fluid, very quick moving electrical nervous reaction that
yeah.
is about as good as we get at stuff.
Yeah. But wouldn't it be great if you could create some kind of video game system that is a total limitation on distraction, so you have full sensory immersion in it to take that distraction element out, and it engages your body as directly as possible so that you're not aware of the tools you're using to participate in this world.
Okay, when you put it that way, sign me up for like Lawnmower Man stuff.
Yeah.
That sounds great.
Exactly. So, and I think that's sort of one of the promises of virtual reality is that in some ways it can help you lock into this state of flow even
uh-huh.
deeper because of those things, that it limits your awareness of the tools. If it's good, that's the big qualification. Now,
oh, right.
I'd imagine that bad VR is actually even worse than a normal video game because you're hyper aware of the tools because they're making you nauseous. Nauseated.
Nauseated, yes. Well, I mean, they might make you nauseous as well if somebody's watching you. Smell
yeah.
really bad or something. I'm not sure how that would work out. But okay.
But do you see what I'm saying there? Like,
sure.
the virtual reality has to be extremely good, I think, before these benefits start to become manifest.
Right. So what are we talking about when we're talking about VR equipment being really good?
I want to offer up one thing that I think is one of the most important, which is the low latency effect. So latency is, it shows up when, so imagine you're wearing a VR headset and it is displaying to your eyes what you're supposed to be looking at. And ideally what it should do is track your head so that when you turn your head, it's just as if you were turning your head in real life.
Oh, right. It renders out the image that's over to your right or over to your left or above or whatever. So that as you move, hypothetically instantaneously
yeah.
or near instantaneously, but
yeah, but the problem is that this is like massively processor intensive,
right,
to
yeah.
track you like this, and that if you move quickly, I mean, just you're creating a problem there, that if you move your head too fast, how's it going to keep up? Your eyes don't really have a problem with this usually. But it can be really unpleasant to wear a headset and you're supposed to turn and you see frames dragging, you know, lagging behind you.
That just gave me like physical shivers. That sounds so incredibly not fun.
I'm sure. Yeah. It's just headaches and nausea and you want to take it off.
Uh-huh.
So in order to have a really good VR experience, you've got to get that latency level down. And this is one of the biggest hurdles.
Right. Because the human brain actually processes things a little bit faster than we can see them. We tend to fill in blanks, really before we get to a next thing that's in the corner of our vision. And what it equals out to is that really anything more than a 50 millisecond difference in latency is going to be problematic. It's noticeable.
Yeah. So I read an interesting article from this July from the computer scientist and roboticist Steve Laval.
He's actually one of the kids working with Oculus Rift right now.
Yeah. And so what he said is basically that 60 milliseconds of latency is considered the upper limit most of the time, but that he himself notices a lag effect when latency is greater than 40 milliseconds.
Oof.
And so that's difficult. He cites the work of Michael Abrash. I'm not sure how to pronounce that.
A-B-R-A-S-H. Sure. Uh-huh. Yeah. He works for Valve. I think he might also be, he's been involved with Oculus a little bit, but I'm not sure if he's actually on the team or not.
Yeah, but Abrash claims that VR developers really should aim for 7 to 15 milliseconds just to be safe. So where are we today? Well, here's a quote from Laval's article. Basically what he says is that for a game running at 60 frames per second, the latency when using the Oculus Rift development kit is typically in the range of 30 milliseconds to 50 milliseconds, including time for sensing data arrival over USB, sensor function, game simulation, rendering, and video output. That's a lot of work the computer's having to do.
I mean, that's not bad. I mean, that's faster than I can do those calculations personally. So yeah. I'm pretty impressed. But
and then he points out that basically that other things can drive the latency up even more, but still that latency is a lot better than it used to be. Now, he also mentions the interesting innovation of predictive tracking, which what that would do is it would measure the angular acceleration of your head, and it would try to predict actually the next frame instead of just waiting to see what you do and then showing you.
A start rendering out stuff that it suspects that you're going to be looking at next.
And so if you start to turn your head, it says, well, you're probably going to turn it about this far. And I know that the next frame I should serve you is this. And so current algorithms can already predict like 20 to 40 milliseconds into the future with good accuracy. And that could, in theory, cut down on the perceived latency to the user to less than 20 milliseconds. And that's really good.
Yeah.
But the Oculus Rift is sort of where it's at today in terms of VR technology.
And they're basically the only, like I said, they're still in development, but the only proposed consumer level, I mean, their pricing is looking at like something like $300 when it finally does come out of development, which is nothing for a virtual reality headset.
Where did they come from? Like, I just became aware of them when suddenly they were a huge success.
Okay, so this fellow Palmer Luckey, who I mentioned a little bit earlier in the podcast, who's like 20 or 21 years old right now.
What?
It's pretty annoying, right?
Did he ever play the Virtual Boy? He couldn't reach it.
Actually, yeah. I think he probably has because he was a huge VR hobbyist. When around the age of like 16 or so, he got really into virtual reality equipment as a hobby and decided in 2011 to launch a Kickstarter for a DIY kit. And he was aiming to make like 100 of these things to be sold to other hobbyists. He got the attention through this of John Carmack, who's the co-founder of id Software, like lead programmer on like Wolfenstein 3D and Doom and the Quake series, like kind of big important dude in video games. And John Carmack asked for a prototype, and Palmer Luckey was like, yes, please take a prototype, sir. Yeah. Thank you. And Carmack just ran with it. He demoed it with Doom 3 at the 2012 E3, and it exploded in the press. Valve got a hold of a prototype as well, and Gabe Newell and Michael Abresh agreed to appear in the Kickstarter video because just everyone was so kind of enchanted and awed by the fact that this kid was putting this thing together. We've talked a little bit about what it does to solve some of the classic virtual reality problems, but the headset itself is, you know, it's a head-mounted display. You can wear it. It's light enough for a person to wear. It's got these two LCD screens that sit an inch or so away from the user's eyes, and they render the image out from slightly different angles, and also kind of put the images through this warp filter around the edges and then correct it partially with lenses that are directly in the headset. And furthermore, pack the screen's pixels more tightly in the center of view than on the edges. And all of this really replicates how human eyeballs, how round, imperfect, weird human eyeballs see stuff. And then you've got the stuff that we were talking about, and then these accelerometers that are detecting pitch, yaw, and roll. And they're furthermore, and even cooler, starting to work on gaze tracking.
Oh.
So that not only the motion of your head, but also the motion of your eyes will help this computer start to figure out where you're going to look next and what it needs to render. So it's in development right now. A lot of people are playing around with it, and it's exciting. I'm really, you know, they still don't have a release date, but I think that even beyond video games, it could have some really wonderful applications.
Yeah. So the Oculus Rift kind of has a lock on the VR headset market these days.
Right, I mean, now, yeah.
They're where it's at. And, mm-hmm. and it's pretty, from what I've never used one, but I've read accounts online and I've watched videos of people using them, and it's hilarious because they're just overwhelmed.
Yeah.
People say this thing is really cool.
Yeah. I mean, everyone, and it works. Of course, it works best if you've got stereoscopic vision, but you can use it if you only have one eye too. I mean, it'll be a little bit flatter, and I've heard that it's perhaps a little bit more potentially nauseating, but not really discernibly. I mean, not so much that the people who were playing with it would have wanted to put it down.
So we're kind of dealing with the first thing there is that sensory control, like total sensory immersion. Mm-hmm. And of course the sound has to be good too.
Yeah, but it's still working within existing game consoles. They're really planning on releasing this as a peripheral to work with any game console. And so, you know, you'd be working with whatever controller that game at any particular game has been designed for.
So there's less of, what's called the merging of action and awareness with that, right? Because if you're still using these tools mm-hmm. that you have to be aware of as tools, and you're not engaging your whole body in the same way, that's not quite that total level of immersion that we would like to go for.
It's not, although it will get better when you start using things like a Wiimote or one of those wands or the Kinect. The Kinect could be a terrific addition for this.
Yeah, or if you go with like the 90s movies, you've probably got like gloves, right? Like VR gloves. You just put these things on. They look like chainmail or something.
Yeah. I mean, one can only hope that they're like covered in faux skeleton bones or something.
Yeah. But they give you a virtual Freddy Krueger hands or whatever it is. Okay. So there's that option, but I want to talk about something that I think is really ambitious and cool, which is total body movement, virtual reality.
Okay. So how does this work?
Well, the first one I want to throw out there, I'm not really going to talk about this much, but the Virtue Sphere, which is essentially a VR hamster ball. It's a big sphere. You go inside and you run like a hamster, and there you go.
And you're wearing like big clunky goggles.
Yeah.
And all of the photos that I've seen of this thing, it does not help that the very nice participant using it was, you know, like some nice gentleman from the early 80s with like a terrible mustache. And it's it doesn't really look sexy is all I'm saying.
Okay. Well, another option, one that actually this is also caught on Kickstarter, VR treadmills, like the Virtuix Omni VR treadmill.
VR treadmills. I'm picturing something like a, like that Run Zombies Run kind of app, except except on a treadmill and you can see the zombies.
Well, it's not like a straight treadmill. Actually, these are omnidirectional treadmills.
Oh, okay. Uh-huh.
So what it is it's like, imagine you're kind of in this weird cylinder thing that's got a rail on it to keep you from falling out.
Okay.
And then you wear special shoes that interact with the floor of the treadmill. And basically you walk, you slide as you walk. So you're walking, you're using your whole body, all this, but the apparatus keeps you in place as you go.
Okay.
And this allows you to use your legs to move throughout a game environment. And I've seen previews of it where people are running through playing some first person shooter and their movement in the game is based on their running, which is amazing to me because boy, you could get some exercise this way.
Yeah, I was about to say that's a little bit terrifying for me personally because I'm like I would be really bad at Halo if I had to run on something like that.
Or maybe you'd just be better at running.
Maybe I would be better at running.
It probably would not be exactly the same as like actual running, but you'd still be like engaging your muscles in one way or another, even if it's kind of unnatural. But obviously, what you'd be going for is the most fluid and natural experience possible to try to get this thing yet again to make you less aware of the tools you're using, to sort of engage your body naturally to make you feel at one with the task you're doing.
Sure. Okay. Do they have anything that's approaching that Star Trek holodeck of just being able to move around in a free space?
Well, there is there's the cave thing, the cave program, right?
Oh, right. Yeah. Okay. So the University of Illinois in Chicago designed this. Cave stands for Cave Automatic Virtual Environments, which is also abbreviated to CAVE. I'm not really sure why CAVE is in the title, and that's the, anyway, it's a room that uses rear projection tech to project on all six surfaces, the floor, the ceiling, and the four walls. Mm-hmm. And so you can hypothetically, I mean, especially now that we've got fancy, infrared motion tracking kind of Connect sort of stuff, you can track a person's motion in the room, and if you've got really good computers hooked up to it, let them look around a virtual environment. But that's still, I mean, that's not really immersive. I mean, it's on a wall. Mm-hmm. I think that probably at a certain point it's not fooling you a whole lot.
Yeah, so, it sounds cool. But
totally cool. Yeah. I mean, if anyone wants to invite me to come over and play with their incredibly expensive rear projection room, then I'll do that.
Yeah. But how about Project Holodeck? Have you heard about that?
I have not. What's that about?
Well, okay, so Project Holodeck is it's this virtual reality project set up out of the USC Games program.
Okay.
And basically what they're going for is 3D full-body virtual reality.
All right.
So imagine a setup like this. You've got this play space area. It's a flat floor area.
Uh-huh.
And you've got players within it, and what they wear is a headset, and that would be an Oculus Rift. That's what they use.
Okay.
They also use a PlayStation Move to provide head tracking data to interface with the headset. They use PlayStation Eye cameras to track movement of the PlayStation Move wand within the play space.
Okay.
And then they've got hand controllers, which are the Sixth Sense Razer Hydras.
Oh, all right.
And then what you do is you become an autonomous free moving agent within a virtual space while you move about in an actual space.
All right. So, depending on the size of the room, that's going to limit the type of game that you can play.
Yeah. Well, it's mostly going to be limited by the field of the tracking cameras that you're using to keep track of your position.
Sure.
But so the way I saw this working was it was a couple of guys and they were playing a game in this space. But what was going on the screen was they were playing a game where they were manning the battle stations of a virtual airship.
Huh.
Yeah. So they're on this airship.
That's
and
cool.
They say they're like cannons. Uh-huh. And then you got to run over here and say you've got like you're sort of like a swashbuckler. So you've got maybe like a pistol and a sword and you use these wands to control those things. But you also move to the stations and you are moving about freely. And the game, actually the hardware, tracks your movement in the real world and takes you from station to station wherever you go. And so your movement in the real world is mirrored by your movement in the game.
Wow.
So that's pretty cool. But the point you bring up is a good one. The space is limited, so it doesn't mean you can run around anywhere. You'll notice, like, the way that game is structured, it's like you're on the deck of an airship, so it sort of limits, like, it's sort of like those old rail shooter games.
Yeah, sure,
in the arcades.
Sure. Yeah, you're not gonna be able to set a game up like that and have you can't play Madden in that experience. or it would be a really short game of Madden.
Can't keep running. Yeah.
Right. But you know, if you're exploring a house, then you could totally do that in that kind of environment.
I imagine you could move sort of room to room with this if you just suspend disbelief for a moment, like you move to the edge
and then turn around.
You're in this room.
Yeah.
And then you'd have freedom of movement within that room. Still, I think that's really cool. What they're going for is that, you know, you are a self-contained moving entity in this virtual world and you're really moving.
Yeah.
I like it. I like the idea and I like where they're going with it.
So where else do we think this is going? I mean,
well, I have a question about, so obviously, I think the cool thing is that virtual reality is actually getting good now.
Right. That we have the computer processing power and furthermore, just the clear public interest.
Yeah. And so that's novel. You know, it's not just type. It's actually, I think now like the media is sort of underhyping it because they've been burned by the horrible VR hype of the 90s. Uh-huh. And they might not even be realizing how cool the Oculus Rift is and all the stuff like that and all its potential.
Mm-hmm.
But I do have a question, like, is this sort of thing really going to show up in the average gamer's home? I mean, you might go out and buy a PlayStation or an Xbox or a Wii, but are you really going to buy VR hardware for your house? Especially, I wonder that if you're trying to incorporate full body movement, say with like an omnidirectional treadmill or an open space sort of 3D free play zone, I don't know how that's going to fit in most people's houses or within their budget.
Sure. Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, they're talking about the Oculus Rift being a $300 piece of hardware, but that's not taking into consideration that the game development for that kind of thing is probably going to knock the price of games up. Mm-hmm. So it, you know, and games are already what, like $65-$70 a pop. And so I would say that that's probably going to be something for more hardcore gamers and hobbyists who are particularly interested in it, not for the common player yet.
Or I had another interesting idea. This may, well, you will judge if it's interesting. I can't say.
Impressed me.
Interesting to me. What if we saw a revival in the arcade culture?
Ooh.
Because of virtual reality. I mean, arcades used to be a cool, you'd go there, you'd play the big, you know, huge box consoles.
Sure. Games that you couldn't get a hold of or couldn't afford. You know, you could put up a quarter on the machine, but you weren't going to be able to go get your own.
Yeah.
Whatever.
There's not really much of that left today. If there is, it's mostly a kind of, I think, nostalgic or retro.
Uh-huh. Or something so outlandish, like they never really got Dance Dance Revolution up to a point where it was very playable at home. So,
right.
Mm-hmm. So something niche like that.
Yeah, I can imagine VR arcades becoming a thing. Like you and your friends go out, you split the tab for 2 hours of VR space time.
Uh-huh.
And you do something like this. You say you play with the group in a free play zone, with total body movement, or you each get to use your VR treadmills and, you know, you like, you combine your exercise time with your friends, you know, with your shoot 'em up time,
or
with whatever it is you're playing.
I mean, I still very occasionally go out to laser tag, so I can totally see that see that becoming a thing.
So I don't know. I think that actually be kind of cool. That idea seems fun to me.
Yeah, and either way, you know, whether this really picks up as a video game movement or not, the fact that, I mean, this has tremendous applications in medicine and industry.
We haven't even talked about like the real stuff you can do with VR that's not just games.
Yeah, because I mean, this is a terrific toy, but I mean, you know, it's like we were talking about earlier, NASA has been using virtual reality to train its astronauts on spacewalks for a couple of decades because, I mean, as much as you can put someone in a spacesuit underwater, there's really only so much of the realism of space that you can transmit through that kind of experience. And also on I had talked about that psychological therapy center that Palmer Luckey worked in where, you know, you can genuinely help people who've got you know, some kind of major fear about something, get over that. And that's wonderful. Or training doctors for surgery, something like that. If they feel like they're working on a patient, but they don't have to actually experiment on a patient, then that's pretty cool. I've been reading some things about some industrial applications, like, you know, if you create a virtual model of a car or a building, then you can walk around in it, see how it's functioning, see whether it's working or not without having to actually build something really expensive and potentially full of fail.
Yeah, in architecture, I guess.
Sure, yeah, yeah. Or Canon actually put out a industry-level virtual reality, augmented reality headset this year that has like a $125,000 price tag, but is pretty useful for people who want to get that sense of how an object works in virtual space without having to, you know, so that you can just create the computer model of it and get a really good look at it without having to build it first.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Okay, y'all. Well, I think that just about wraps us up for today. I have enjoyed talking about virtual reality, number one, because of how horrible it was, and number two, how big of an upset this is that it's finally cool.
Yeah, that's when something has been that far down, it's even more beautiful when it comes this far up.
I really want to use an Oculus Rift. I haven't, and
me neither.
I would love to get that opportunity. So hey, if y'all are listening, hook me up, find me, one of those on my face.
Anyone out there who's a developer, let us know.
Okay, well, that does it for today. If y'all want to read more, you can go to fwthinking.com, where we've got videos, podcasts, blog posts. You can also check us out on social media, on Facebook and Twitter. We look forward to hearing from you, and we will talk to you again in the future.
For more on this topic and the future of technology, visit forwardthinking.com. Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places.
It's brand new season 2. I'm Marissa Thalberg.
And I'm Stephen Wolf Bedeta. And we're excited to be back having bigger, bolder, and always real conversations.
Straight from the C-suite front lines of marketing, media, and more.
We have great friends joining from people you may know, like Wilmer Valderrama and Bobby Burke.
And people you'll want to know. So grab a coffee or, hey, even an Aperol Spritz and come join us on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Listen to brand new on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and my podcast, Climbing in Heels, is back and better than ever. You might know me from The Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. Climbing in Heels is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters. With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets
and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Johnny B. Goode, the host of the podcast Creating a Con, the story of BitCon. This podcast dives deep into the story of Ray Trapani and his company, CentraTech. I'll explore how 320-somethings built a company out of lies, deceit, and greed.
I've been saying since a very young age that I was going to be a millionaire. If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
Listen to Creating a Con, the story of BitCon on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.